Hello, my name is Lance Weiler. I'm a storyteller and director of the Columbia University School of the Arts Digital Storytelling Lab. You're listening to Columbia DSL's Sandbox, a podcast where we explore new forms and functions of storytelling. Okay, so tonight's discussion is, as I mentioned, is going to be about funding, exhibition, and curation of immersive work. I think we find ourselves at a very kind of interesting precipice with it. And so we want to have a kind of a candid conversation. And we've assembled people who are coming from all different perspectives around this. Tonight is going to be really kind of focused a bit on geolocative work for the most part in terms of what that looks like. I've already said who I am. What I'm going to do is I'm going to pass this amazing mic down the line, and we'll each take a moment to kind of introduce ourselves.
Hi, my name's Jay Lee, and I am the co-founder of Wildrance. I don't know if...
Yeah, maybe you can say what that is.
Okay, so we're a consulting design studio, but we also have a immersive interactive theater space in Lower East Side, where we proudly call ourselves a platform for different immersive experiences. We liken our space to a game console, which is supposed to be a platform for different cartridges to come in. People can keep coming back to the same space, but we built the space so that it can easily transform from project to project. So people keep coming back, and it's a different experience every time. So,
hello, I'm Yvonne. I'm the co-founder of Wildrance, and Jay covered everything for me, so made my life easy.
Hi, my name is Regina. I'm the director of new media for a company called Wallplay. We helped connect artists, especially working with time-based media, to corporate members who we consider patrons of culture. And then within the company and outside of the company, I help artists with time-based media conservation, especially from a documentation perspective, well before it enters the phase of acquisition from an institution.
Hi, I'm Neil Carty. I'm the founder of an advisory firm that focuses on curiosity-led innovation strategy, working primarily with Fortune 100 brands and media companies. And then I also have been dabbling a little bit in immersive production from a producer standpoint.
Hi, I'm Nick Fortuno. I'm one of the other people who brings you all of this from the Digital Storytelling Lab. My hat in this panel is that I have been the co-founder. I'm the co-founder, and I have co-run a festival for the last 15 years called Come Out and Play, which curates new street game work. We curate about 30 new games every year, and we run for about 1,500 people. And the model has been replicated directly as Come Out and Play in Pittsburgh and in San Francisco, but has been, we have sister festivals that basically took the idea and ran with it all around the world, from like Sydney to Berlin to Tokyo. And I participate in the creation of a lot of immersive work in specific locations. The Raven stuff, the Poe stuff, being one of those pieces that I'm currently involved with.
So, Nick, why don't you kick it off with like a question?
Okay. So, given that you're seeing, like, each of you from your own perspectives is seeing work that's trying to get out into the world, and that you're all involved in some part of the, how that work can express itself to audiences. Can you talk a little bit about where you see the state of this kind of locative work? Like, what kinds of stuff are you seeing, and what kinds of difficulties are you seeing artists have?
Well, I'm not really representing artists, but I can speak to the brand perspective. A lot of it right now on their side is educating them on what are the forms that are out there and how to work collaboratively with artists that doesn't turn it into sort of like a branded, manifestation of their brand characters. You know, like, you don't want to see Captain Crunch live. Maybe they do, but the world doesn't, you know, and I don't represent General Mills or whoever that is. But they are, however, looking at, you know, works that are penetrating pop culture in a meaningful way. And I think the ones that I'm starting to see first jump into that are spirits brands, primarily because they're used to the act of drinking happening at these types of venues, right? So you've seen companies like Doers, where there is a Captain Morgan's experience happening in a 3-month run in London underground with lakes and all sorts of things like that. So they're testing it out because it's part of entertainment. I think the key is to think about how are brands, how can they get involved in a way that feels more like patronage than it does sponsorship? And that's what I'm trying to help artists understand as well as brands to act like that.
to carry on the conversation between like what are brands interested in and what are artists interested in, there's whether there's overlap in regards to storytelling and immersive, what I've actually worked with in the last year, oddly, is augmented reality. There are a lot of companies that are interested in that, but they don't fully understand what that means. So I have to take time, and neither do the artists, honestly, in terms of what that means for, say, their intellectual property of that AR, or how would they even store the AR for archival purposes if it was given to the company, and does the company know how to store that information? So I and my company normally act as a bridge to try to help make sure that documentation still exists and that it can be seen by the public and be used by the company in a meaningful way. So that's just one example of quite a few different technologies.
Really quick on the AR thing, one thing just to any of the artists out there, right? Like that is something that brands are already experimenting with. So, right, if you're trying to pitch something, like they probably have the knowledge base and the tool set to go out there and move on to the next level versus doing something that they've never done before, right? So AR is something I'm hearing from every single brand that they're investing in.
Although I would say that it's also tricky because, well, Blipper, for example, just kind of collapsed. I think they may be acquired now and try to move on. But a lot of the systems that are up to par, like especially for like a corporate activation, are incredibly proprietary. AR Kit 2, for example, that's Apple's, is maybe the best right now. But down the line, will we be able to see that work in 10 years even with updates and tools and all these issues if Apple isn't willing to allow like full access to their code base?
So I think for our company's perspective, we are faced with a lot of artists that they don't lack ideas. They have a clear vision of what they want to do. But either they don't have funding or they don't have a space they want to perform in, or they don't have a clear idea of how to make it actually happen. So usually the idea or the product is good. And when they approach us, since we have a space, even though we also design, is kind of helping them sort of how to make it happen from our perspective. And I think funding is usually the biggest challenge that we've seen so far. I don't know if you want to add to that.
I guess that is the. I mean, that's why we exist, is because funding is lacking in a lot of immersive experiences. And because of that, I think it's a snowball effect of people are more afraid to try out new different genres, mashups. We currently just ended our run of Mortality Machine, which was a difficult project to put out there because it was a mixture of LARPing with escape room, with immersive dance, and that kind of thing is hard to bring to market if there isn't funding or if there isn't opportunity. And I think, but I do see the current trend where more and more people are becoming courageous, brands are taking interest in either helping these products come to life or at least exploring different opportunities. So we're all at a place where we can just kind of roam free, wild, and find new ways to like put something immersive together. So
I think what's important to note, you know, if we talk about the funding, there's only a handful of ways that you can actually fund the work. You know, one is like a patron model. The other is the potential of brands. I think you see, private equity is another way that you could potentially do it, but it's very hard and it's very speculative in terms of what the work is without the ability to have scale in and around it. And then I think the other would be something that drives from ticket sales and the ability to kind of create value in and around the work. But those are all models that are very positioned around a value proposition is very capitalistic, you know, which is interesting because in some cases we're talking about things that are art forms that haven't, maybe they're difficult to classify or they're hard to explain until you actually do it or you experience it. For instance, I'm working on a piece right now that's going to be at Tribeca next in April. And I prototyped it here. It's called Where There's Smoke. Like when I go to classify what it is, it's it has elements of a live documentary. It has elements of an immersive theater experience. It has elements of an escape room, but it's also something else. You know, it's like this kind of, it's a space that allows for people to kind of step into an environment that allows them to experience a narrative, but then also be reflective of their own memories within it. And it has the opportunity to be kind of an empathetic healing space, you know, so it will go up to Columbia and we'll do an install in the hospital of it, right? So, but it's something that somebody could come to and interact with, and it's an experience that, you know, runs about 60 minutes or so for four people at a time, and we can probably cycle through eight people within an hour or whatever. But that type of work is, there's the challenge of educating an audience to what it potentially is, educating funders to what it is, and the challenges that are associated with it, right? So in total transparency, because we're always incredibly transparent here, the way that it's happening right now, I need to pull together $65,000 between now and April, right? I have a whole bunch of different ways that that's happening, through patrons, through potential brand, through some underwriting, and then through crowdfunding. So it's like a piecemeal kind of thing, but I've done it many, many times before, right? And that you have the leverage of the festival. We're collaborating with Wallplay, which has an on-canal initiative, which is really amazing in terms of 22 storefronts, right, on Canal Street, and a whole art district that they're working on, and I won't steal the thunder of that. But you know, I just want to be real about it, right? Because like when you're trying to make the work, there's a big time investment to what it is, right? So you need to be equitable and fair to the people who are putting the time into actually doing it, right? And so that's a side of the conversation that's really important. So trying to figure out like what I just laid out to you, probably realistically about 67% of that 65,000 is people's time. Right. It, you know, there's a technical and a physical build out. You know, there's people who are sharing their times and talents. And I think a lot of the immersive work falls into a position where it's exciting to try to make it. And I think a lot of the festivals, at least you see film festivals doing curation of this work, and it's following models that already exist for film, which is not appropriate for this type of work, because as you're finishing a film, because I know I've been a filmmaker for 20 years, as you're finishing a film, your costs are for the most part reducing, and the amount of time is reducing, hopefully outside of delivery once you actually sell the work. But with this type of immersive work, you're finding out, and then you have a window to try to produce it in. So like when Nick and I did Frankenstein AI, we found out on November 13th that we were going to go to Sundance. And then between November 13th and January 13th, we built the whole thing, we funded the whole thing, and made it all happen, right? So, which was crazy because we built out the AI, we did the installation. It was a three-part installation. It was incredibly ambitious. But we couldn't fund against it until we actually had the festival associated with it, right? But then the festival couldn't program it until they had seen everything else that they knew was going to exist. So I wanted to kind of lay that out because there's that whole other side to it.
I think that frame becomes really interesting when you think about those funding relationships. It's like, okay, well, you can somehow go to a whole bunch of people and say, like, because Mortality Machine did this. It's like Ryan Hart, who built that experience, like, is a well-known figure in the LARP community. He basically went on Kickstarter with that LARP community and was like, please give me money to put on my show and I'll get you a ticket, et cetera, et cetera. And that, I'm sure you had a lot to do with that relationship, but that was like, that's kind of what we're talking about there. And then there's these sponsored relationships that come from specific brand activations or ongoing relationships with corporate entities, and some of those exist as well. And then there's ticket sales, and then there's underwriting from like a variety of sources, which, you know, when we talk about private equity, we're talking about everything from friends and family, like your rich so-and-so who just decides, well, I'll give you some money, whatever, to like actual venture firms making plays towards platforms. So as a starting question, because all of you mentioned it, I think the one that artists generally are the furthest from are these corporate relationships. Because like if you were at the Immersive Design Summit recently, like half that room were people with a story like, oh yeah, you know, I used to like do these crazy installation projects in my basement, and then I would make these little art pieces, and then I decided to put on a show and I made $200 at it. they're not people who understand the relationships to these kind of things. So could you give like a picture of what those relationships look like and what those kinds of, like how you make contact with those people and what they're looking for?
Sure. So I think first it's important to understand, like for those corporates to understand what it is that they're funding, like period, right? So it's like, or what they're buying. I think there's the, like let's set aside the patronage model for a second, because that's just like, I don't care. Like, I want you to make this happen for the goodwill of whatever society and art. Then there's like thinking about like what is it that the brand is buying into, and that is either one of sort of a few things. It's like audience, right? The people that are there are people that align contextually with them, that either consume their products or feels that there's a jump that you can provide deeper engagement with them. The second is that can that brand integrate into that story in a meaningful way, either in that one-off installation, or is it something they could see taking on the road for the benefit of those products, right, at a further level? And then the last is sort of I guess that's sort of the integration model too, but it's like, is this going to help them to get more brand awareness that they're investing in this new form of storytelling, which has an innovation sort of model play that they just get cred off of that? And those are usually the three things I see most. To answer the question, how do you get in front of them? It's really tough, right? Like you have to either, you know, be out there block and tackling and like meeting people in the field. And a lot of like what I've built my business on is being that curator, right? Like a CMO doesn't have time to be out here sitting here or going out at IDFA or all these different things. How can things be packaged in a way that it's used them seeing it in their language? So talking to people that work in that space to get to that point before you bring it to a marketer, you're gonna have one shot in front of a brand to do that. So it's got to be tight. And all those numbers behind the audience, behind the revenue models that are there, where I mentioned like the Captain Morgan's thing, like they're actually driving money out of that through ticket sales, which is what Lance mentioned. So there's a lot, I mean, to think about, but that's sort of my take on it. You have to think like the corporate to get there.
Well, you definitely covered a lot in terms of like the KPIs that the brands are looking for. We have a platform, Wallplay, that we're launching. And that platform has a group of already like corporate interests where they are members, they pay a fee, and then they just to browse our network. We have a network of over 200 artists, right? So they browse this network, and artists who feel comfortable posting projects that they're currently even working on now that aren't finished at that R&D phase, which I think is one of the biggest issues in terms of funding, was what we're talking about. They're allowing these brands that are vetted and have a contract with us to view these to get funding earlier. And there's built-in analytics that show that following artists on this journey to fruition, to showing in maybe one of our 22 spaces, so there's actually like an endpoint, has results for their company like brand loyalty. They can actually see those numbers. These are things that they're interested in. They don't get enough numbers now. And that's part of what they don't understand or why there's a risk factor. So we're trying to help solve all of that right now. And most importantly, teaching them how to value artists and say, yeah, you could go to an agency and you could work with a creative director who could copy this artist, but I think that with the internet and with younger generations, they can tell the difference between something that's like genuine and coming from like a genuine creative practice and from something that's been created by an agency. And brands are starting to realize that too. So this impact investing, social impact investing kind of environment is something that we want to take advantage of, you know?
For us, I feel like it's a little different because we're not really working with brands. A lot of times it's more artists coming to us and we work with them. In that perspective, I guess we can see ourselves as the, not really the brand. But from that perspective, I feel like a lot of times it's finding if whatever show or projects that we're taking on, does it align with our mission statement or what our company is looking for? Or is it something that's new that can be implemented into our space or our work that we can learn from each other and actually improve and grow either the community or just our skill sets? Not quite the brand part.
Well, I do think that one of the biggest problems, and I think all of you have probably experienced this, is it's really hard to convince someone of something that's brand new without having a real thing. Mm-hmm. And that's not just like some mood boards and a great description. It has to be, I mean, the most effective way to communicate, like, this is what my project is actually just to build the prototype. And
that, as you had mentioned, requires an incredible amount of time and energy and sometimes a lot of money. And I think people are becoming smarter. There are also a lot of technology out there that currently supports more faster builds with less effort than previous. So a lot of IoT things are great. And it's we've seen a lot of also success and growth come from immersive companies that have never run a business before. And then they're like, oh, faced with the idea of I have to sell 300 tickets. How do I do that? And being able to do that themselves, figure out a marketing plan, putting it out there, finding the right language, also learning who are their audience. And all of those pieces, I think, can only really come from actually doing the full thing, even though technically it's a prototype one. And I think that also may be alleviated in the future with more better education for people understanding what you're talking about. I mean, whether it's audience members or brands or other people that are trying to work with you. But so far, currently where we are, it's you just have to build the physical thing and allow people to see it. And the more people that other people trust, whether it's reviews or, for example, our newsletter now, people know, oh, if we go to the space, there's something of value that I can get from it. So building that trust is key. It takes time, so.
Can you talk about the model? Because I think what's interesting about what you're doing is you have like a programmable space. And when I say programmable space, it's not just the fact that you're curating work in it, but you actually have a plug-and-play space, right? Mm-hmm. So you have a space that allows people to come in and potentially R&D what they're doing in terms of a show. Can you talk about that and talk about what led to that particular model? Because I think what's interesting about that is you have, I could say, it's a model that allows for, like, if you look at theater, there's a mm-hmm. model around this idea of workshopping a play, right? Mm-hmm. So you have this space where people can come in and they can effectively develop, right, the work within that space. Can you talk about the model and what you're working with?
So we built the space specifically after seeing two very giant gap between production value and content creation. So at the time, we had just seen Sleep No More. And also around the same time, there was the first escape rooms in New York. If anyone has been to one of those at the very beginning, the production value was very low. So we realized that space can basically, people understand and appreciate space at the production value of what Sleep No More was offering. But there could be a variety of different immersive experiences that can use that. And we come from an architecture background. So we're like, why don't we try to build a space where it isn't a theater? Because that's not where we believe immersive is going. It's obviously has to be some place that has no stage, that every room is a set. And we used a lot of what we call design methods based on our architecture backgrounds as well as some other experiences that we've had to try to create a space that can be malleable and reformed to the program that it's trying to support. That can be physical things, that can also be technological things. So we have each room has Wi-Fi controllable lights as well as hookups with Raspberry Pis and Arduinos to have different inputs and outputs. The outputs are usually lights or sound, but other things can happen as well. So one room that we currently have is a white room that whatever, basically based on lighting, sound, very minimal set changes, that room can represent a forest to a incubator to whatever you want it. And those two things combine light touches of spatial, whether it's dressing or spatial design in combination with the technology that we have, we're able to really have a magic show for 2 months. And then a week later, we have an immersive dance piece. And 2 weeks later, we have a project that we're currently working on called Inheritance Project, which is more of sort of setting up setting up a platform for a larger piece to capture other people's stories. If anyone's familiar with StoryCorps, it's kind of like that, but specifically talking about people's inheritance. So it's we also built the space with other potentials in mind. For example, working with ITP, where students really need a place to come in, code something quickly, and see how it really works in real life. Because a lot of times, I mean, I learned the hard way, where you're like, oh, I can work with one light bulb and one other speaker and program something and see if it works in your beta testing. And then you bring it to a space and you're like, oh, no, it definitely doesn't work. You need to have a lot more power or a different rhythm or different times. It takes you. It's sometimes hard to wrap your head around how long of a time it takes from one person to walk 10 feet versus 30 feet, and having that space walking around a sofa or a table or under a large light pendant, it's we realize that it's valuable to have that information. It's hard to have that if you are not in a space that allows you to be creative and not have bought out tickets for it already.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to add anything to the model?
No, that's pretty much.
That's pretty much it. Can you just say the name of it again?
Oh, it's Wildrance. It looks like Wildrance, but it's not
Wild
pronounced.
Children-ish.
Yes.
Okay, excellent. Mm-hmm. So, can you, Regina? Can you talk about like kind of the idea of the you know, coming in and kind of looking at the model that you have around what you're doing with Wall Play, what you're doing with On Canal? Can you talk about that specifically?
Sure. So On Canal, in terms of space, I will start, is on paper pretty is challenging. So what we do is what Wall Play is when we take this concept of working with the artists or working with the brand, and sometimes often working with the artists directly without funding too, because we have relationships with property owners around New York and growing around the country, but the most visible project is On Canal, these 22 spaces, where we have a relationship with the property owners where we can take over these spaces for a year, 2 years at a time, and then work within our own artist network or take submissions, word of mouth, to fill all these spaces consistently with art content. Like I mentioned, sponsored, unsponsored, anything you can imagine, rented, we take it all. Often we think about themes around them. For example, we're doing Armory Week, opens tomorrow at 7 p.m., where most of the spaces are filled with art content. We have Nada right now. But it's Canal Street, right? I don't know how many people are familiar with what Canal Street looks like, but these are storefronts that used to have like bag sellers in them, and they're, it's retail, it's storefront retail space. So there are incredible challenges when you show virtual reality work. We showed the Digital Museum of Digital Art for 3 months in a space, and having that set up is challenging, but it worked. And when it works, it's incredible. And even if it's not at the highest production value, we don't ticket. And one of the reasons we don't ticket, and it's more about a patron model or an underwriting model, is because we want to get as many people in the door that wouldn't enter a gallery or museum naturally as possible. I want art to feel relevant to demographics, age groups that just don't enter these institutions. And we have had that. We had up to like 100 people a day seeing this virtual reality work, three headsets, and I'd say 90% of them said it was their first time ever using virtual reality. And it's incredibly important to get those people in the door who can't also afford to go to an institution that's $40 a ticket, because we have tons of those events going around the city, because having more people experience this in as many ways as possible is going to push the technology forward when it needs to the most. So that's why we are able to do this project, or why we care about doing these very large scale retail projects.
Just real quick, what's the foot traffic on Canal?
It's about 1.8 million people a month. Yeah.
By the way, we're on Canal too. So.
Oh yeah,
amazing. We're neighbors. So yeah, I mean, and that's not every single person entering the space, but there's 1.8 million people passing, and being able to enter without any barrier at all to experience art often with that's technology forward.
I have something to add to that too. I think one of the things that I'm talking to a lot of brands about these days, and it sounds like there's a similar vein to that, like what are their distressed real estate assets? I mean, there's tons of coverage around the death of the shopping mall and unused retail space, right? And I think there's a lot of smart real estate developers out there on the commercial side that are thinking less about like sales per square foot and more about experience per square foot. And the second that that changes, they realize that, okay, everyone has a phone and they can go, you know, shop on Amazon or whatever it is. But if you can create an experience that drives them into the showroom in a meaningful way, then that actually could actually drive more sales. So the more that these types of works can get taken up in even small pieces of that, it's interesting. If anyone's been to like Story or Camp, if you're familiar with those concepts. I mean, that company got bought by Macy's for a reason, for an exorbitant amount of money that they're programming the same way inside of those retail venues. So like, I think there's a huge opportunity for artists out there if positioned in the right way, aligned with that particular brand, whatever it may be around. Like, let's use climbing Everest as an example, right? Like, you can see that in REI or in LL Bean in a second because they're selling that type of product. But how does that then, that work, as long as it's meaningful, sit in that space? Gets a lot of credibility for everyone. Across the board.
So, well, I mean, like it's interesting because I think to me one of the issues that you brought up that I found in like I guess every single career direction I've ever taken in my life is this loop problem of like, yes, we want the new work, show us the new work. Well, the new work costs six digit X. Oh, well, then show us something that starts the work. Okay, here it is. Could you show us more because this doesn't make sense to us? Okay, here it is. Could you show us more because this doesn't make sense to us? So I'm not going to name the project because I don't want to be a jerk about it. It's not my project. But I met a producer on a project that was like one of these kind of immersive, like transmedial immersive projects that had won an award from a major foundation. And when I saw her, I was congratulating because I was like, oh, that's so great. You won an award. That's terrific. Because I was so happy that some piece of work had won an award. And her response was, Nick, do you know when we won that award? A month after we finished. Because that's when they could actually see what we made. And so a lot of times I think the difficulty on the arts funding side, which works like pretty well for other small budget projects, doesn't work in new media, because when you go to film festivals or people who fund dance performances or people who fund theater, they don't understand what you're making. And so when you try to say like, oh yeah, this will cost $150,000 to make and it'll look like this, and they see what you have, there's this big gap that they don't know how to jump. Now, I think that there have been vehicles around this. So the question, and it sounds like all of your work has been in the process of like thinking about how to package these things so that different sponsors or patrons will buy them, or thinking about how artists can communicate their work. So what I'm curious about is, in your experience, or if people were working with you directly, what would you want to see of work that's early that you think is effective to communicate to people?
I'll be really quick on this. Like, it's sometimes to the artist, like sometimes good is good enough, right? Like every artist that I've ever dealt with is like, they want to spend a fortune. And as long as that platform or property, let's use film festivals as an example. Like when I go to them, and I haven't really gone to a ton until the past couple of years, or like it's been a long time, I'm always like, I walk into these immersive experiences and I'm like, aside from the throughput, the festival's not doing a whole lot to actually bring in potential funders in there, you know? And the more that they can view that as a platform for business development on behalf of those artists, the more willing those artists should be to invest money into that prototype. But they don't do it, right? So like when I work with people, and this, you should ask this of any producer, if they're not saying that they're going to stack the room full of brands or potential investors, then they're full of shit. Like straight up, right? So like people that give you an opportunity and say you should be taking on the cost, if they're not bringing potential buyers in there, then they're a waste of your time, right? So like thinking about what you can build that's good enough to show just enough, and the second that they ask you, well, I want more, well, great. I'm in the development of that, but at the same time, I'm talking to one of your competitors. So pretty much like come out there and tell me whether like this is something that you like, we need to move forward, and you have to be willing to say no and not just chase after that dream brand or company for that matter.
I personally am a bad example of like what I look for, because I'm very conceptual, and when I fall in love with a project early on, it's because I'm reading their white paper like, and I'm like, oh, this is amazing. Like, I want to see that come to life. But what we help do is basically teach artists how to make decks. And that's the simple first phase that it's timeless already, you know. But it's creating schematics. And a lot of it in our case is our relationship with our patrons of culture already. Like, when we sit down at the table, they already respect and trust us, and word of mouth and all that. So when I sit down and I show them a deck, it's different than just like an artist showing a deck themselves. Or, like, as I said, they don't even know what a deck is a lot of the time, unless they're speaking with us, and we really whisper them through like every single step. And then, as I mentioned, if the brand is already working with us, they're more willing to fund at the R&D stage and see that come to life. And you mentioned buying, which is interesting. I'm still interested in relationships where they're not outright buying it. It's more of like a licensing agreement. It interests me much more. So that's one of the ways that we have that workaround.
I apologize for my trauma of growing up in indie game with all that.
can you explain what you mean by buying?
What I do? So, well, I also want to talk, there's a few things that I didn't mention too about stealing projects when they're in the R&D phase, if it's like an agency or a brand, and how that's an issue that you see all the time, you know, that artists vulnerably putting themselves out there. But in terms of buying, so I really care about artists, as I mentioned a little earlier, keeping intellectual property. So when a corporate entity is interested in working on a project and they ask to outright buy it, but it's not like a commission, it's more like, can I use this for corporate means? I've literally talked with brands, large brands, lawyers, about like if they're interested in licensing deals so that the artist can keep that, or like have situations where they can still show the work separate from the brand, and how do we differentiate that or show that it almost is a different addition. And so I think that's valuable to artists, depending, especially when we're talking in the context of like, it's not an artist jobbing necessarily for a brand, right, where they're making work that the brand totally dictates. To put in context, mostly talking about really convincing brands to fund artist projects, like artist projects that they want to be showing, that is articulating like their practice. It's a lot of teaching process. I've sat with lawyers for like 2 weeks convincing them why an artist has to keep their intellectual property. And I often argue that it's for archival purposes. And I truly believe that, but it's also a workaround.
Yeah. Otherwise, go to an agency, right? If they want a brand-supported thing, then that's the role of an agency.
So, yeah, I'll talk about that a little, too. So, and we do work with agencies, too, who have brands, right? So there's sometimes, like, a step over where agencies are part of our network as well. But when you're in that R&D phase, often they don't finish funding the project. They say, oh, you do all the work, and then, oh, we really like this idea. Let's show, like, a crappy version of it, right? So we hope to stop that process as well, and we have examples of stepping in and scaring the brand from doing that, which I can't really speak to.
I think that there's a real interesting thing, the connection between what you all have is this role of curation, right? This idea of like an investment in time to help kind of develop something, a potential platform or access to network in order to incubate or help push it into the world. Can you talk about the value of that curation? I know, Regina, you were just mentioning like when you take a deck to someone and you say you're kind of vouching for it, right? So they know you already. But can you speak to, you know, just your feelings about curation, the importance of curation within this work, how you go about it? That would be great.
How do I even start? I mean, I feel like this side of the industry it's growing, but it hasn't had like that nerdiness of like, I have an MA in art history, you know, so I'm coming into like a corporate, for-profit, technically becoming a B Corp entity, not answering like a traditional museum institution. I think if there was more people with my background that were interested in working on this side, then they could empower artists in a new way. I always call it like the way that we do things is alternative funding. It's an alternative route to actually have artists hopefully make a salary every year off what they're doing, sometimes on one corporate project that we've convinced the brand to take on, right? I feel like doing curatorial work sometimes in the way that I would do at like a more traditional institution, but with that like money on the line, with that artist value. I don't know if you're familiar with Wage. I've just learned about them recently. They call out like nonprofit entities for not paying artists to show their work. And like they do it based on their operational costs. It's like, well, if this institution has this operational cost, then they can afford to actually pay the artist this much to show their work. I'm thinking about that from the for-profit perspective too. Like this artist shouldn't just be getting a production budget from the brand, which brands do. Like we're talking to a brand right now that was like, we've never paid an artist fee before. We usually just cover production, but like, what would an artist fee be? They asked us and we were able to be like, well, it should be at least like $5,000 just to pay them to do this.
That's part of the artist, not just, I mean, I get a lot of artists that will send direct costs to the brand or agency, and they see the production costs, and they'll go, okay, then we'll pay you exactly that.
Right,
and then
yes.
You find out the person's worked for 6 weeks for like $500, and you're like, well, don't do that again. You know? I mean, it's like, don't tell them how much, like, agencies are marking it up. You can do the same thing. There's no reason why not to get yourself paid.
Late, great Ryan Clark said very famously to me at a conference at Ford's Last Story that if you go to a degree that ends in an A, you should take a class in business as part of your degree. Mm-hmm.
Neil, can you talk just briefly about like some of the nuance of that, like how you're negotiating those things and how you're thinking about it when you're in that relationship with the brand where you just said, don't pass it directly through. Can you talk about markups? Can you talk about like some of those?
Sure. I mean, what you have to understand, part of what I feel like my role sometimes is like, I'm in a very challenging spot, right? Because part of me is getting paid by the brand. The other part is me trying to like help foster the ecosystem of the artists. And someone gave me some early advice when I started in consulting was like, if you're not telling a brand that they're wrong enough, they feel that they're not paying you enough, which is 100% true, right? So like I try to go in there and say like, this is more of a cultural change. Like you go in there, understand what the brand ethos is, and then say, let's identify curation areas that then align with those ideals, right? And then you say, here's how you have to interface with them. And the thing that will scare them the most is a PR shitstorm. So if you're like, all right, you piss off all these artists, it's going to turn into much, much more of a problem for you than it is to toss them that extra money for an artist fee. And I think the smart ones that are out there, personally, I won't work with brands that they don't think like that. So it's like they have to be fostering something on the larger good. But then on the markup side, I mean, on the agency side, look, agencies' margins are already stretched really tight. Brands are crunching them to like nobody's business, right? They're not even getting paid for the IP that they want to be developing. So they're going to try to get as much as you can out of it. So just, you can don't have to be that transparent in saying that this is what it's costing to produce, because an experiential agency certainly is not doing that, right? They're like marking up probably 30 to 40%, if not more. Because a brand doesn't know how to get access to that, those people. I don't know if that answered the question. I mean, it just go after, you know, authentic and real brands. The rest of them don't waste your time with.
So what I would say. Translate that. Whatever you put down is the amount that you think it is.
Mark it up
by 30 to 40%.
Right, and then start as that's your negotiation part, right? Assume they're going to bully you down a little bit, but you know, don't start at the point where the money that you need to go. And the last piece is also what I'm sort of finding is that there's a lot of these like it's a labor of love project, and that's really dangerous for all the artists, because the second that you do something for free is the second that every other agency and brand thinks that you can get that for free. So set a standard out there that it's like, this is what it costs, and put it in very realistic terms, like, would you work for 6 weeks for free? No. You know, like, I'm not just, would you just cover the cost of the agency? I mean, which I think that's a much larger challenge across the industry to like say that this is the common wage that we get or what it costs to do that.
Well, the issue sometimes is that plenty of creatives almost want to work for free. They're just so eager to create the work, and it's teaching them like, no, you deserve to be paid for this.
Right.
I had that conversation too many times. Like, I want to pay you.
That's exactly. And I mean, when I work with artists, and more so this is for me, that's a labor of love, but it's allowable because it's like, that's part of my passion thing, right? I'm not trying to make money off of that, but I'll still ask like, well, Like, how are you investing your time? Because that just doesn't make sense to me. You know, unless you're a trust fund baby and you can do whatever you want, then that's fantastic. But, you know, you got to think about what the cost is of doing something else or getting paid. So,
if we could, maybe we could talk about what it was like. I heard you at the Immersive Design Summit. I thought it was interesting because you talked about how the space, you were a little early. It was. And if you could talk about being early on the space and then talk about how you're dealing with kind of the support of the work when it's in there and your ticketing and things that you've learned in terms of like how you ticket the work, how you, you know, how you break even or make a profit on what that is, if you could break that down.
So we often say that our space was about 2.5 years too early. The industry wasn't ready for, there wasn't enough creators that needed space that we were offering. We saw that there could be a need, but obviously, also I just don't think they were coming out of the woodwork fast enough. I think there might have been other creators out there. We just weren't bridging the gap fast. But
and plus we weren't, because we were new, and so it always takes time for people to get to know that this kind of space exists.
What is this space? Right. Is it a production space?
It also took us a while to market it right, so that people know what it is.
But in terms of, so while the space was growing its audience as well as its potential partnerships, we were constantly creating new content to bring in a variety of audience members, from people that would be into LARPing to people that would be into immersive theater, people that would be into puzzles and gaming, et cetera. And that some of them were totally free events just to build the audience base. Some of them were ticketed events just to, that was project specific. And that part, I think, was kind of the those are the harder parts, because you don't see the turnaround as fast. And nowadays it's much easier, and it's also, we've learned a lot about general ticketing. Like, you shouldn't be ticketing the price to what you think people are willing to pay, because it's, you're putting out there something that's usually undefined. So you have to figure out, like, how much is, how much do you need to pay on an ongoing expense versus an expense that has already happened? And also, like, we have the same situation where we're always telling our partners, like, you have to pay yourselves too. You can't just, like, factor in, like, your dancers and you know, your stage manager and not pay yourself from all the time that you've put into creating the work. And we actually always constantly come across a lot of people that are like, oh, what's your business model? I mean, you seem turning around many projects that different so fast. You're basically stopping the project before it can become profitable. I mean, most projects, the longer you leave it on, the more profitable it is. So, but our strategy is really to, once we believe in the projects that we curate. So we try to find projects that not only fit in our company's sort of ethos, but also projects that we believe can have a much bigger life outside of our space. So that's where our business model comes in. We have a piece of each project that we work with. We're usually, sometimes the projects don't need anything, they just need a space. But most of the time, a project needs a creative director or a set designer or something else. And that, it's a different business model, because you're not getting the money up front, and there's no guarantee that that project's going to succeed outside of your space. But it is something that we heavily believe that it is something that can sustain a business. I mean, we are currently sustaining it, so that it is possible out there. It's not a standard business model, but it can work. And I think other business models that aren't standard can also work. Mm-hmm. People just haven't been able to explore it yet. Mm-hmm. So one project that comes to mind, and it's largely due to the partner that we had, is our magic show called Six Impossible Things. It's by Joshua J. I don't know if any of you have seen it. If you haven't, you should see it. It's pretty cool. Six Impossible Things. He is a sort of a powerhouse in himself. Like, he's in the industry, he's very well known. He also brought in press in terms of, he went on Jimmy Fallon. He went on, well, there are other places he's going to that we're not allowed to talk about. But so that, we can't take credit for that, because that was not our doing. But also, we did see, outside of his fame, we did see a marketing team that we work with for that specific show. They put a ton of time and effort and money into just AdWords. We had friends coming up to us for, like,
probably 2.5 months after we first launched the show that we're like, every time I search anything, that show is popping up everywhere. I wanted to stop. And we're like, that's not us. That's really the marketing team. They figured out how to like piggyback onto all these keywords that were like immersive and interactive and magic. Magic is a keyword.
I think the other thing is like the challenges, because I'm going through this right now with the project that I mentioned, Where There's Smoke. This is like identifying what are those potential hooks, right? Like, so I know that immersive storytelling is one particular hook for it. I know that there's a mystery that sits within it. You know, it kind of deals with growing up in a firefighting culture and these mysterious fires that happened and, you know, me questioning whether my dad had any involvement with those fires, right? So there's a mystery element to it, like very serial-esque. And then there's a component to it that's really kind of about the empathetic healing of it, right? So like identifying those potential stories. There's more outlets that are starting to cover this type of work, which is great, you know, like, you know, Brian Bishop at The Verge covers it. You know, some folks at IndieWire are starting to cover it. You have all the work that No Proscenium is doing, you know, and they cover a lot of it. But I think it's like identifying the hooks. And actually, you know, I've crowdfunded a couple times before to mixed success, you know, sometimes really well, other times not so well. But going through that process of just prepping the campaign for it is really incredibly enlightening because it makes you think about how you're actually going to convey this. Like, how are you actually going to explain what this thing is? How do you balance somebody who's going to look at it and say, I have no idea what an escape room is. I have no idea what you mean by a live documentary. I have no idea what immersive theater is, right? And so how do you come down to the core of whatever that human element is? I'd say, to answer your question, one project that, you know, like a number of years ago, I did a project called Pandemic, and it was very difficult to explain what that project was, but it got phenomenal press out of Sundance when it was there because it was so different than everything else that was going on. But it was also a lot of hustle around it, right? It was like, how do you actually work the festival? How do you actually do your own press around it? How do you actually communicate the authenticity, right? A lot of people will just blanket releases. A lot of it is like, okay, can you build the relationships with the you know, like I've placed a lot of national stuff just because I took the time to actually write to the person to actually explain. And a lot of times they'll be excited about that because they're talking to somebody who's directly connected to what it is, as opposed to somebody else who's just a publicist for what that is. And sometimes it's just like a joint effort, you know, like, you know, how can you combine those two things? But I think there's a lot kind of, you know, in your question, there's a lot of challenge to it. But I think I'm optimistic that I do feel like in some ways, this kind of work can spark some type of a new movement in terms of how the work operates. And the more that the work is authentic and true and people can, it resonates emotionally, and it's not just, not to knock a lot of the experiential stuff that exists, which tends to be like selfie and Instagram driven, things that actually have a little more purpose to what they are. So then people look at them and say, oh, okay, I get it. That's kind of like these other things. I think I might give it a try.
Can I just say very quickly, the Museum of Ice Cream is not a museum, right? And I mean, in no way, shape, or form is it a museum. It's a ridiculous name. But I hear museum, and I have an expectation for that experience, which matches the kind of experience I'm going to have in a general way. And one of the biggest lessons we learned from Come Out and Play was many years ago, we got a grant from the Lower Manhattan Cultural Council to put on a bunch of events in Lower Manhattan, and we basically ran over 5 weekends a game every weekend. 4 of those games we ran at like between noon and 2 p.m., and there were games for about 10 people that would run in cycles in the middle of the day somewhere downtown. And one of those games ran on a Friday night for 150 people in a public park as a starting place. All of the games we ran from 12 to 2 had almost no people. It was basically walk-up traffic. That one game we ran on Friday night filled instantaneously. And we analyzed that afterwards, and we talked to other people who run festivals afterwards, and we thought about why. And it's like, well, because if I told you you were going to spend an hour and a half on a Friday night doing something with about 100 people downtown, what are you doing? Can you think of something you might be doing? An entertainment event. Concert, a movie.
right? Like, that fits. Like, you know what you're going to do. You're going to go down there with your friends, and then you're going to have a drink afterwards. You're going to eat afterwards. You're going to do this thing. What do you do for 15 minutes at 1 o'clock in an area you don't go to? Like, nothing. You do nothing, which means you don't do that either, right? And so, like, part of the approach to the audience when it's unknown work is to, like, you don't innovate everything. You innovate the stuff that will shine in the innovation, and you standardize the stuff that people are looking for that makes sense. And when you do that, then you get people in the door, because where is the theater in Sleep No More exactly? It's a dance performance, right, that you wander around and look at. And if they had sold it as that from day one, it never would have got people, because nobody would know what the hell it was. But you call it theater, and then it takes 2.5 hours and it costs like $100. That's what people expect from theater. Like, no one's surprised by that, even though it's not what it is at all. Like, literally nothing in the experience resembles what you would go to see for theater. But that word has meaning, has expectation meaning. And I think part of the problem is that, like, when AR experiences in particular manifest, like, there's no sense of what I'm going to do. There's no sense of how this thing is going to work. It just doesn't fit into a bucket as an audience member, I understand. And so you either have to hustle it like crazy to give me a picture that it's like a weird, interesting thing that I'm worth taking, or make it look like something I know, and then I'll come in because I know what to expect. And if it matches that expectation, then the innovation of the AR or the locative or the immersive is going to shine really bright, because it's like a theater thing except in this brand new way. And that's a much better place to be, I think, than that weird thing that I didn't know how to comprehend. Because that weird thing I didn't know how to comprehend is probably not something a normal audience member will go to see.
I guess this question is kind of VR specific, but what are some of the alternatives to showing at a film festival? You know, that's going to get you the type of recognition or visibility in order to continue making impactful work.
Does anybody want to take that question from the panel?
So what are the platforms for VR? Is that the, or what are the opportunities for distribution?
Immersive installation-based work that may have a VR component, or?
I mean, for VR, it's a challenge. I mean, I've seen a lot of things that seem similar, where it's like they're creating entire theaters or you know, gaming centers where people can experience that, but the cost of entry on the headsets is the most difficult thing. I don't think there's been a viable model out there that has figured out, which is why it hasn't taken off to the degree that everyone has hoped yet. I do believe that it will. As far as creating more content, I think there's a lot of like platforms that are beyond festivals as well that could be corporate summits, right? Like, are you familiar with Two Bit Circus at all, right? So, like, that's a good example of, like, what does a carnival look like next? And they're running a lot of different installations, and hopefully more of those types of things emerge to create that. But, I get those same questions a lot from – I don't necessarily always know the answer, right? Like, some of it does have limited run or limited potential until more of that content or more of, like, the platforms are out there to support it.
I've had some pieces at festivals, and that doesn't necessarily guarantee that you're going to have support to make something else. So, you know, how do you navigate that? And, you know, what are some, I guess, alternative institutions that can be created where people can come and see and engage this work? Because there's a level of privilege that comes with even being able to attend a festival.
Yeah, I think hopefully this answers it, right? But it's like scalability at the beginning, right? You have the most immersive piece of production that may sit at a festival where you have a smaller throughput or put through, however we call it, right? And then when I talk to brands, it's like, all right, well, that can live in very different ways. Then it's like, then that lives on PlayStation, let's just say, that doesn't have all the components of immersion in it. And then the next common denominator is like, you know, it's a Happy Meal box that turns into a Google Cardboard, right? Like, and that's sort of how you have to like think is like, this is the level that you're going to get the scale, and hopefully that they then decide that most immersive piece, if that's even a, like, gets taken on the road at potential like tailgate parties or Super Bowls or college football circuits, right? And I'm coming from a brand background, but how do you map out where that could be in different forms and iterations that doesn't necessarily have to be the full product? And I think that's a good way to frame it in your mind about how you can get there.
I'll give two examples. One, we had this event with a group called Movers and Shakers. you were in that show and you had a VR piece there, a really great VR piece. And one story really resonated with me from Movers and Shakers. They told me that a mother and her son walked in. I want to say he was younger than a teenager. And she saw that she had access to this show with all African-American artists, some working with technology like yourself. And she cried and she told them that she's never had this access before to work that resonated with her and that she could show to her child. And I think part of that has to do with something I spoke about earlier with it being a storefront and not being an institution and not having this like ivory tower type barrier, although I'm not fully against that. I'm, you know, as I've also said. But I think that though, I'm not sure how that necessarily relates to the work living on in terms of funding, right? Because yes, we're giving a solution for getting more of the public in to see this work, and maybe that has a long-term supply and demand for that technology. So that's one that comes to mind. And two, also with our On Canal project, if we do end up showing where there's smoke, then I've been arguing for having nights that potentially are more open to the public, right, that aren't ticketed, and how would we be able to balance this to get more visibility, right? Because I believe in that. So it's thinking about also, yeah, how to structure that financially. And of course, it's a challenge.
I think that, you know, in terms of, I've been having conversations with a lot of different artists about doing collective kind of shows, right? And kind of looking at it and saying, okay, well, what does that look like and how does that work? Nick is working on a white paper that we'll release through the Digital Storytelling Lab that's kind of looking at exhibition in particular, the things that are necessary around it, how to think about it within a festival context and outside of a festival context. But I think what I hope starts to happen, and I think you see it with the space side here, you know, each of the groups here has space that they're allowing artists to come in, do, and make work with. The platform that Wallplay is working on to kind of connect patrons to whatever that, you know, artwork is. But I think, like, inevitably, a lot of it is the hustle that comes after what you do with the work and how you position it and what the story is that you can tell with it and how that work can live beyond just a festival kind of screening, you know. And I think a lot of the work that we're doing through the lab and that I'm doing personally is always kind of looking and trying to find, it's almost like systems thinking. What are the different ways that it could be, that it could work? Like, what is, you know, with Tribeca and the opportunity to do this thing with Where There's Smoke represents a potential offsite experience within the Tribeca Film Festival, right? If that happens and the festival starts to spill out onto Canal Street, that becomes a totally different scenario and it starts to expand the category as a whole, right? So that's a, like, that's an important thing because in the past, in my experience, I've always tried to look and say, is there a way that the technology or something that's happening here can be introduced and help to drive a category beyond just even the work that I'm doing, you know? Like, that's kind of why we're having this conversation here, because it's like to have to climb that, you know, push the boulder up the hill every time doesn't make any sense, right? So, like, if there's a way to alleviate that or start to derive systems that allow for the work to be seen so audiences understand it, so people who could potentially fund it understand it, and so us as creators or artists can better understand the work that we're making and critically talk about the work that we're making to each other, so then we can get real about what it is and move beyond the kumbaya moment of, like, isn't this great that it's immersive technology? That's where we start to get to something that's more meaningful in a number of different ways. And so I think that's kind of the problem, right? It's this shiny thing. It's kind of exciting that people don't fully understand. That's kind of falling into pre-existing models, and it needs new models. Like, I love this quote by Buckminster Fuller. I'm always, like, dropping it. I'm going to paraphrase it. Don't waste time fighting systems that exist. Build new systems that make the old systems obsolete, right? So, like, you know, how do you do that? What does that look like? That's going to be what we're going to do in the second part here. We're going to solve all these questions, you know, so, like,
you're going to solve
Yeah. Exactly. You're going to solve them. Not us. We'll solve them together. Actually, you were going to say something.
Yeah. I mean, this is this could be just a question for you as well, because I'm not entirely familiar with your work. But we had done a piece called Here with Kelly Bartnick from she was original Bald Witch at Sleep No More, and some of her other some other collaborators as well. And at the end of the work, there was so much support that from people that were not able to come, also because this is all location specific work. We had access to a 360 camera. We took footage of it, and our intention was really to just put it all online. The intention of the project itself, it was supposed to be an immersive episodic work. So every so often it'll come back and it'll continue, similar to a TV series or sort of episodic movie series, if you will, I guess, or sequels, basically. So there was an idea of maybe putting that online and allowing people that were not on site be able to experience something similar, maybe not, obviously not the same thing. But there was enough information that we got from potential audience members from an online platform that we saw that, you know, even if they don't have the proper VR headset, maybe they'll be able to look at it on their phone or get one of the like more affordable bottles that are out there, just so that they can have this experience at home. So I do think that there could be a way to make this a scalable model online that is not physically location specific. It's not a solution, but.
If I could riff just for a second on one thing, like I think what we're kind of, another thing that you can look at is like when there's an emergent CAD, a new emergent technology or platform associated with it, right? Like, so we're leaning with the Raven into spatial audio and we're leaning into the Bose, you know, glasses because there's a platform that's going to exist there. And then there's something really fascinating about being able to do something with audio, you know, that is different. But then it, you know, audio tends to be able to go, like if you look at the history of audio in relation to visual mediums, audio is always there kind of first. You know, it's smaller packet sizes, data, you know, like it's able to transfer and, you know, faster or whatnot. And audio kind of always has an interesting jump on where visual is. You know, some of that stuff will probably change with, you know, 5G or the promise of 5G and what we'll be able to do off the cloud with AR or whatnot. But that idea of like looking and identifying new potential technologies, you know, like Bose, I know, is dropping over 50 million in terms of building out that work. They have a whole showcase that they're going to be doing in and around South by Southwest over over the interactive portion or throughout the festival. So sometimes it's like looking and saying, is there a new emergent platform? What can it look like if I create across that platform? And then maybe combining that in some way with a potential festival and then being able to live beyond that in some way that allows you to leverage that platform, you know, so.
So like a good example of this is a project I got funded as a project called The Waiting Game, which I made with ProPublica. And I worked with an interactive designer at ProPublica named CC Wei. The way this project got funded was that I wanted to make something about the topic of asylum seekers after the election because I was really, really pissed about the way people talked about people seeking asylum and refugees because I work with international students and it was ridiculous. So I thought of something that I could make on my own, like just by myself, because I didn't think anybody would fund it. And I called Cece because I know her just randomly from going to conferences and hanging out in interactive spaces and basically said, hey, I'm working on this thing. I want to tell you about it because I just want to know if it's journalistic. I had absolutely no intent of working with ProPublica at all. I just networked the thing to see if I could make it better. And when I spoke to her, she was interested in it because ProPublica was doing immigration research already. They already had articles at work, and she saw the connection, and we started talking about what it would be to partner with ProPublica. Now, if I had known ProPublica was doing immigration work, I would have contacted CC the day I thought of the idea, because that would have been a partner that I could have worked with from day one. And if you do research into those kind of institutional things, you can find some of these partnerships if you're aligned right. The trick to it, though, is that the thing that you're passionate about might not be the thing that these grants are passionate about. And so finding the common ground between those things can often be tricky. But there's lots of issues right now that actually do have potential funding if this is something that you're interested in pursuing. So anything around veterans' health and PTSD, there's a lot of attention to. If you're interested in education, you basically aim at eighth grade because that's where all the money goes. I can explain why if we had more time, but I don't want to waste it. But there's a specific reason. LGBTQ groups are funding a lot of media content right now, like just like different foundations funding media content specifically to kind of like specifically stuff around not just identity acceptance of individuals, but discussing things like coming out processes and trauma around coming out processes. And so, like, there are a lot of these organizations around. If you go looking for them, you can find some of this stuff. It's just, again, to Lance's point before, a lot of hustle, right? Because they generally don't do a good, very job of communicating with you. They generally don't broadcast what they do. And the hustle becomes much harder because, like, if you're working in your medium around things like film festivals, you're surrounded by people who half understand your medium already. If you go to a conference for physical therapy and you try to pitch AR, no one in that space has any idea what AR is or what it costs to make or any of that stuff. So, like, on the one hand, they'll be super excited that you're there because, like, they probably have never thought about AR before. And if you can tell them that story, they'll be really, really excited about it. On the flip side, they have never made a media project at all. So they have no idea how to do that. And so it's a very different kind of hustle where you come in not just as like the practitioner, but you also come in as the bridge to successful product creation. But if you're comfortable doing that, there's a lot of interesting spaces to work in and you can do some good. Although, again, I want to stress, like, probably not at the level of corporate sponsorship funding. And rarely at that. But an SBIR, a Small Business Innovation Research Grant, which the government gives out a few dozen of those in different agencies every year, is $150,000 for phase one and like about $900,000 for phase two. And it's not a loan. It's a grant. And so there is and that's the low stuff. If you go to NIH for cancer, you're talking about millions of dollars. So there are, if you have a project that fits those things, there are ways to get them funded.
Well, it ties a little bit to what we were just talking about in the cause. I mean, one of the things to think about when you're going towards a brand, depending upon the piece of work, cause-related, purpose-driven work is not judged under the same KPIs as things that are meant to drive sales, right? A lot of it because a particular executive, it's probably part of his legacy planning from a brand perspective, and like they don't care how much money they're throwing towards it because they want it to show at World Economic Forum, another platform, like to think about conferences and things of that nature. And then what not to do, I mean, I've seen it all. I've sort of seen it run the gamut, right? But I mean, come in with your numbers tight about the growth of the particular sector or the medium that you're working in to demonstrate how that could drive value for the brand and think about, you know, how it's scalable.
I mean, I'll echo that. I think numbers are really key. Like if you're going in for the first time, it's more difficult, right, to convince that your project, if it's not directly brand related. But if you have any previous experience getting funding, even grant funding, just showing that you have like a track record, the more numbers you have, the more track record, the more history, the more press, I would pump that all out at them. Press definitely works. I hate to say it, but because I don't like it myself, but Instagram followers, social media helps so much, even if they haven't seen your project. And when they see like that you have multi-thousand, even a million followers, then they view you as like an influencer. And to work in this side of the industry and really help artists, there's a lot of dirty language on the corporate side, I'll call it, right? So you have to use those kind of terms sometimes to be heard by the brand, and they work. And you still get your vision. Earn media.
Right. Learn the bullshit buzzwords that they use. That's what I would say. Is like,
yeah.
As a tip. Like, look at those South by Southwest panels. See what's rising to the top. Throw those words out there. Guarantee you.
How many people
make sure if they know them.
Know what we're talking about when we say KPI? Just out of curiosity.
Okay.
Cool.
Key performance indicator. Sorry.
Great odds.
I'm in recovery from the corporate side.
Okay. Well, I want to thank our panel for taking the time to share their insights. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. If you're interested in exploring new forms and functions of storytelling, make sure to check out Columbia DSL's new prototyping community. You can find out more information at digitalstorytellinglab.com. This podcast is brought to you by the Columbia University School of the Arts Digital Storytelling Lab. Special thanks to Peter English for composing our theme.